on. We'll have the forecast here for now. The Senate Interim Committee has to adopt its rules. Dr. Warner, any notes that we need to know about these?
No, Dr. Warner, there's no notes.
You need to open
go into a work session.
Okay. The only thing, only comment I'll make, Mr. Chair, is that these are actually from the prior interim. Leadership offices are reviewing those, and any modifications that they make, you would adopt in your meeting in September.
Okay.
So, but these are the identical to the ones you had last interim.
Mr. Chair, I move the model rules, and then I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves the model rules be adopted.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to adopt what leadership says. We're going to adopt these rules. Thank you, Mr.
That's
President.
Right. Clerk will call the roll.
Okay. Sorry.
Everybody's already out of practice.
Okay. Senator Riley is
I saw him
not
coming
here.
In.
Upstairs.
He came
okay,
in.
Senator Bertschinger.
Yes.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yes.
And Chair Hess.
Hess votes aye. Rules are adopted. We can go forward.
Riley can carry those.
Smith will be here in about 5 minutes.
Okay. Should we proceed then?
Stand at ease for that long? No, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I think we can start.
Okay.
No public hearing, then we could just go
we'll
to
just,
the session
we'll
when
just,
they
we'll
get
just
here.
Come, we'll just start up when they get here. Right.
Okay.
Well, for the purpose of this hearing, we can convene, can't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All
right. For the matter of less than quorum.
Yeah. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order, and we'll ask the state economist to come forward and present his piece, and we will move to rule adoption when we have a quorum for that purpose.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Hess, Chair Barnhart. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner, here to give the September economic and revenue outlook. So in general, the economic and revenue outlook for Oregon is pretty stable compared to 3 months ago. But that said, as we entered the last three or four weeks of the biennium, we really did see a surge in personal income taxes and corporate income tax collections. And so if you recall, at that time, we were right on the envelope of the kicker threshold and unsure whether or not one would be realized. But given the how strong the end of the year finished, it put us squarely into kicker territory, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But looking forward into the current biennium, 17-19, resources are relatively unchanged compared with what we were expecting when the budgets were drafted when the legislature was in session. So in general, we've seen, you know, some things are pulling down our expected revenues going forward, and the kicker being one big factor that we expect to weigh on revenue growth in the current biennium. But we're also getting some negative headwinds from our macroeconomic outlook, in particular, a weaker outlook for corporate profits, weaker outlook for inflation, which feeds into our wages and our income numbers, how fast the inflation rate are. And so these things are pulling down the outlook in 17-19, but they're being offset by some positive factors, the biggest of which is we have increased significantly the outlook for lottery sales. This was done. Our original estimates of the impact of the new Cowlitz Casino in Washington are not coming to bear, and so we have pulled back the amount of impact that we expect that will have on our local sales. And we also see positive benefits from the ending balance, which is larger given the late season surge in revenues, and also because of the legislative changes that the legislature made during the last session, increased some taxes, cut some spending, and took some funds from the lottery as well. So all these things together, we're looking at next biennium being pretty similar, pretty darn close to what was expected when the budget was drafted a couple months ago. So In terms of the economic update and outlook, recent performance is still pretty good. The first chart here shows all Oregon labor market indices, which are current indices or contemporaneous with economic activity for the most part. And all these are really headed in the right direction. Employment's up, unemployment rate down, wages and salaries up, and the hours worked among manufacturing industries are holding steady at above 40 hours a week. With the hours worked in manufacturing industries, we often see manufacturers start to pull back on the wages before they start to cut workers. You know, they just work their they just work a little bit less hours and a little bit leaner before they, you know, take on the fixed cost of eliminating workers. We're really seeing none of that yet, and the manufacturing recovery appears to be back on track after stalling out in 2015 and 2016. So for the most part, most of these things are all good for now, but we are definitely feeling a slowdown in Oregon across most of these indicators. You see here wages and salaries have slowed down, but more broad forms of income have as well across the board in terms of retirement income, investment income, wages, the like, have all slowed down in Oregon quite a bit. And that's also showing up in our tax data, and maybe even population growth appears to be slowing down a little bit as well. But that said, putting it in perspective, our growth is still looks great compared to the typical state. We're still one of the fastest growing states in the country by most accounts. But nevertheless, we certainly are seeing some pullback and some slowdown in recent months, and that has persisted. There is some upside risk to that. The last couple of months, the one indicator that's bucked the trend has been the preliminary employment estimates that we've got. The last few monthly employment estimates, some of them have been really big, you know, in thousands of jobs a month. Those are still preliminary, so we'll wait and see, but it does lend hope that there is some upside there as well.
Okay, we've achieved a quorum, so I'm going to recess the hearing just for a minute, don't move, and open a work session for the adoption of committee rules. Representative Vance?
Move the adoption of committee rules, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance moves the adoption of the committee rules. The committee rules are the ones that are published in OLIS this morning. Among the five of us, any objection to that motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Close the work session and continue with the hearing. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. So looking across Oregon's regions, we're really seeing improvement across the board, and now we're even seeing some of our most struggling rural areas starting to find their footing as well. This is a little bit tricky to interpret, this employment graph. What it shows are the dark lines on the left side there are how far the jobs fell in these given regions during the recession. So hardest hit was Central Oregon, lost 16% of its jobs during the recession. The Oregon statewide total just over 8, so about half as severe the decline in jobs during the recession. And as you go farther to the right, the furthest right, that's where we are today. So for the typical area in Oregon, we now have 8% more jobs than we did heading into the recession, than we did in the pre-recession peak. So that's quite a big swing. And you see here, you know, so we have some really tremendous swings in the epicenter of the housing downturn and in our biggest metropolitan areas. But the Central Oregon and Southern Oregon, you see here, had the hard, you know, were among the hardest hit. Those are the places where we really saw the biggest problems in the housing sector. And but as you've seen, they, you know, it took a little while to get online, but now they are really roaring back. And Central Oregon's the big one there, where you see you know, a swing of 28% in just in a decade in terms of the jobs. So if we
excuse me just a moment, Senator Bowser.
Thank you. In looking at your chart, obviously the South Coast remains to be problematic, but in some of the Central Oregon and some of the other areas, Portland's easy because it's a metro. Have you dug into the details, like in Central Oregon and Willamette Valley and Southern and some of those areas, to look, are most of those urban job creation and in what sectors? Because like in my district, of course, I've got little teeny towns, which are still going down, not up.
Yeah.
But, of course, as you point out, I have larger cities. What I'm seeing in my district is larger cities gaining jobs and still that big urban-rural shift.
Yes, Chair Barnard, Representative or Senator Boquist. I think it's still fair to say that most of our larger metropolitan areas still have a growth advantage relative to the rural areas. Now, that said, over the last couple of years, that growth advantage has eroded some as our high-flying metros, our biggest ones, are slowing down, and some of our hardest-hit rural areas are picking up. So that gap has closed, but there's still a gap there. So we're still seeing, larger areas, more diverse economies do better. But that said, we're starting to see more diverse growth even in the regional areas, where we're starting to see a lot. At first we were seeing gains in, housing-related sectors and the like, but now it's really broad-based in most areas, the growth. And so that's encouraging, and we're starting to see some diversification. But I think your observations are true in most of these regions, Central Oregon being a good example. Here we see, I said, the swing is amazing at 28% over a decade in terms of increasing your jobs. If we just looked at Deschutes County, it would be more than a third, the job if we cut out Crook and the others, they're even in the, this region, we see that dichotomy where the rural areas are tending to lag behind. But the most encouraging thing is here in the last couple of years, as we've seen our bigger metropolitan areas slow down, and I talk about overall state, we're starting to see a slowdown. We are seeing acceleration in some places, particularly down here at the bottom in Southeast Oregon and the South Coast. These places are growing a lot faster than they were in 2015. Coos County, Klamath County, Josephine, Lake, Grant, Wheeler. All of these places have accelerated significantly. Jackson, too, if you cut out Medford, that's starting to do better as well.
Thank you. So to follow up on that point about Southeast Oregon, this is the total number of jobs, correct? This is not the unemployment rate.
That's right.
So it suggests that Southeast Oregon, that we have 4.1% fewer jobs even today, even though our unemployment rate is the lowest it's ever been, or at least in the last 40 years. I think it's 3.9%. But that means that people have either left or quit looking. Do we know which?
Correct, Representative Bence. You're right. We're still at 4% fewer jobs than the pre-recession peak. The unemployment rate at the low, so what does that mean? The labor force has dropped. Why has the labor force dropped? As you point out, there are two main factors. You could either leave the area or drop out or stop looking for work, and then you're not counted as in the labor force. And the demographic impact as well, as you have aging folks not necessarily just choosing not to look for a job because they can't find one, but there's also retirement's a factor and other reasons people are dropping out of the labor force. And with the large baby boom population cohort in a lot of these rural counties, exposed. But that said, the overall top line population isn't dropping much, if any, in most of these places. It's slowly declining in broadly in places like Harney County and the worst hit ones. But most of the decline that we've seen in the last 10 years has been to labor force participation of some sort or another, whether it's retirements or discouraged workers or the like.
Right. Follow up.
In my area, we of course we're right next to 800,000 people across the river in the Treasure Valley arena. But in the South Coast, it seems like people that would leave there are unlikely to come back. In our situation, next door, they could go. They might move 100 yards away and be outside of the scope of this study. Is there some way of knowing the overall lasting impact of this loss of jobs by virtue of where those cities might be located? The South Coast seems to me doesn't have that 800,000 people next door that Treasure Valley, I guess, I don't know if the word enjoys is the right word, but there's a ready labor force there to draw from in our little area. South Coast, I don't know where they're going to get those folks. I don't know. Maybe California. Who knows? But I guess the question is, do we draw any more from these numbers about the future Are those people coming back? That's my question.
Yeah, Chair Barnett, Representative Bentz. You know, in terms of the labor market, we usually look at a region or a metropolitan area, so we can, in a lot of measures, we're including the folks that are across in terms of, you know, what they bring to the labor force. So when you're looking at the unemployment rate, that's a household survey. Often, you know, it depends on where they knock on the doors and tell you, you know, do you have a job or not. With the standard employment numbers like these are based on the establishments where you're actually looking at places, you know, in your area. And so, yes, you can look at these differences, and we can look at how much income commuters make as a share of the overall income in any of our regions. So we can see if that's growing, the share that's good, that's commuting, and it's a little bit harder to flesh out exactly what does that mean for demand for housing and services and the other ancillary economic activity, but it will give you some sense about how this is changing over time. But your comparison with the South Coast is a good one. The South Coast is one of the places that really across the U.S. is amazing in terms of how strong the employment or population growth is. Right, it's not that's right. You know, they gain 1% a year or something, or 0.5% a year. Not doesn't sound like much, but it relative to other places that have experienced the same sort of shocks to their anchor resource and manufacturing industries, that's an incredible number. Most of these coastal communities have lost more jobs than the Rust Belt. You know, Youngstown, Ohio is like Lincoln City in terms of the amount of shock it took. From losing its main manufacturers. And so in places like Youngstown, Ohio, what happens? Everyone, they lose their job, people leave the area. With the Oregon coast and a lot of southern Oregon, that has not been true. However, the mix is changing. A lot of the folks that are moving now are there retirees, maybe not necessarily full-time in the labor force anymore. They bring wealth instead of income. And moving houses. Meanwhile, a lot of the working age folks are still flowing out of Coos County and the like. And so this creates issues for the workforce as well. The one positive for some of our most distressed eastern counties is that these demographics in terms of the migration trends are stronger, that they're getting more of the working age population cohort than a lot of places are. And so that's, although population growth is slow, in a way they're getting good population for economic activity.
Senator Burschager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any charts or numbers on participation rate?
Yeah, we do. We do. And we're actually going to hammer a little bit on participation. I know our friends at the Employment Department have been getting a lot of requests from legislators about it, and they asked us to talk a little bit about it. I'll hold off the answer to that until after Josh gives the spiel on it, and see if there's any more open questions after that. But it's a huge impact right now for our participation rate. Is a big deal for us right now in terms of where we are in the forecast, because we're at this point where we say, okay, the economic expansion is maturing, so we're starting to get some constraints on our ability to grow. And the biggest one being it's hard to find workers now in a lot of places, and they're getting scarce. So as we go into this next biennium and we're expecting slower job growth, slower revenue growth and the like, the thing is, well, is there more slack? Are there more people on the sidelines than we realize? To what extent, can these breakneck rates of growth that we've seen over the last couple of years and then again over the last month or two in the preliminary data, to what extent are those sustainable? And so that's one of the things we're gonna hammer on with the rest of this section.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we turn back to the previous slide?
You bet.
Thank you. The comment I'm going to share isn't necessarily mine, but it's one I hear regularly from business owners throughout all of Oregon as I visit with them. There's a perception among business owners that the reason they can't find employees is because many folks have become, in quotes, professional gleaners of state and federal programs. Is there any validity to that? And then I guess I would follow up with a question. You just made a comment that folks are on the sidelines or perhaps on the sidelines. What does it take what is that impact of having those folks on the sidelines? And I guess I want to go back to my original question. Small business owners are struggling to find labor. They believe the labor's out there. They believe many folks are professional gleaners and therefore are not entering the workforce. Do you have a thought on that?
Let me just add that I'm aware there's been a bunch of studies done on this topic. This might be, just a hint, a topic for one of your blogs down the road, so to actually bring in some of that research. But go ahead and answer the question.
Yeah, Representative Smith, Representative Barnhart, we're actually getting started on that, and we'll show you a couple of preliminary slides on this today, and Josh is really hammering into this and is working on the narrative now, and it will become a blog post. But one of the issues is, well, let's look at people in one facet of gleaning, I suppose, would be, I probably shouldn't use that word, but one facet is disability, federal disability payments and the like. And we certainly have seen, relative to where we were before the recession, we've seen an increase in folks claiming disability benefits. There has been some increase. That said, there's been a much larger increase in people who report that they're not looking for work because they're ill or disabled. And so there's a big chunk of people that are saying, well, I can't get a job because I have a bad back. And so for the economic purposes, we have to try to get to the bottom of that. To what extent is it maybe just saving face because it's self-reporting, and now you're asking me why I don't have a job? Well, I hurt my back. Or maybe there's other reasons that might be influencing why you can't. Maybe substance abuse or things like that, that might be keeping you out of the workforce, but you might not be able to get benefits for. And so, again, we'll get a little bit into that. Hopefully, Josh will enlighten you a little bit, and then we can take any follow-up questions with it. But yes, there has been an increase in folks on federal assistance, but it doesn't explain the large labor market shifts that we're seeing.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. So in Southern Oregon, certainly a perception of the difficulty in finding workers is that they're all fleeing for the cannabis market. It's hard to recruit a restaurant dishwasher if you can make $20 trimming. So my question is, as we've gone to legalization, have all those cannabis jobs out there been incorporated into the job data that we're seeing?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, Representative Barnhart, the Employment Department is starting to put together definitions of a cluster for the cannabis industry. It's kind of difficult we run into problems with our industry codes like we always do, right? If you're a place that makes edibles, you show up in bakeries and confectionaries or whatever, so you're in there with the cupcake shops. And so it's hard sometimes to pull these things out. But we're starting to get numbers. Those numbers are growing rapidly, but mm-hmm. they're still relatively small. What's the most recent, do you know, in terms of the Employment Department?
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh. Looking at the detailed employment data that the Employment Department is trying to comb through and figure out who is a dispensary or an edibles, we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 jobs for the industry overall. If you talk to people within the industry, they're saying that number is a lot higher, more like 12,000. But they're basing that on the number of OLCC permits for being a bud tender, to handle it. You have to file just like if you're a server of alcohol. But even if every person that does receive an OLCC permit does work at least for a little bit within the marijuana industry, it doesn't mean that's a full-time job, right? There's a lot of shifting, cycling through of these people and their seasonal work. So we don't have a really good number. The 3,000 to 4,000 number is a direct job hard thing for people that are on payroll paying unemployment insurance taxes, but that's an undercount of the overall jobs. But similarly, that OLCC permit number would be an upper bound on that. So the truth is probably somewhere in that range. And to your question about the forecast, those 3,000 to 4,000 jobs are in our forecast.
Well, and would probably be concentrated in Southern Oregon as well,
yeah,
a lot of them.
So.
And so that, for a regional labor market, that can really move the needle. That said, it's not necessarily a bad thing that there are more jobs. It injects income in the area, and hopefully that will, allow some of the retail trade folks and hospitality industries to increase wages maybe to compete, and that's good for everybody. So hopefully there can be some good outcomes.
This is a question not for today, but for somebody to be thinking about how to study it. We have big swaths of Eastern Oregon that do not have a broadband connection. The best they can do is a dial-up connection over a landline that was put in the 1930s as part of the laying out of the telephone system. It would be useful, I think, to know what effect the lack of broadband internet has on this economic activity that we're talking about, if any. My bet is that it's significant in getting bigger, but I don't know that. I don't expect an answer today, but that would be something for idle moments to be working on.
Well,
I believe that the legislature ought to be working on policies that will get broadband to those smaller communities in Central and Eastern Oregon that show up in that very large area that doesn't have any broadband coverage now.
And we are.
Good.
Yeah, no, both anecdotally and published work, we've got quite a bit on that. And here, obviously, anecdotally in Oregon, it's a big deal. Some businesses won't come. They won't even consider your region if you don't have the infrastructure.
Right. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
But we are seeing some diversification in rural Oregon, which is encouraging. This graph shows public sector wages as a share of all wages in rural Oregon. And as we know, given the lack of a diverse economy in a lot of rural Oregon, public sector and government jobs take a disproportionately large share compared to the rest of the state. In a place like Burns, you've got half of your workers in the city are public sector workers of some kind or another. But across the business cycle, these public sector wages aren't as sensitive, and they don't necessarily move at the same time as private sector jobs. And there's a bunch of reasons for that I've laid out on the right in terms of how sometimes the funding streams behind these jobs are not necessarily right in lockstep with the economy. And then also the demand for public services often rises in weak economies. And so as you see here, you get some pretty drastic shifts to the public sector in rural Oregon, or dependence on the public sector during recessions. And in the last couple of recoveries, we've seen some improvement going back the other direction. And that's certainly the case today. And we're starting to see diversification, and most of the growth in these now accelerating rural areas is coming from the private sector and from a broad range of different industries. And so that's encouraging. To the extent that we can diversify the regional economies, that should protect them from shocks and also improve their growth prospects going forward. So with that, I'll pass along to Josh. He'll get into some of this labor market and reasons for participation.
Thanks, Mark. Again, for the record, Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. Before we get into the participation discussion, just wanted to flag another issue that's feeding through to a lot of our underlying economic models. Even though the broad spectrum of economic indicators out there are all looking really good, or at least decent to really good, one that has been a little bit problematic in recent years has been the slowdown in personal income. We've seen it here in Oregon, we've seen it at the U.S. level, and we just went through a major annual revision at the U.S. level that's fed through to the Oregon data too, where the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, once a year, sometimes they'll go back and they'll revise their data based on a more complete sample and tax returns and all this sort of stuff. And what they did is they basically lowered overall personal income in the U.S. By a percentage point or so. In Oregon, it was just about 1%. At the U.S. level, it's a little bit different than that. You can see here, this is just growth rates year over year. You can see it's trailing down over the last couple of years from 5 or 6% in 2015 down to 1% today. This is adjusted for inflation. The difference in the two lines is due to the revisions. The gray line is what was published as of May 2017. The blue line is June of 2017. So you can see the impact of the revisions. They raised 2015 up a little bit, said 2015 was better than expected or better than we had previously estimated, but everything since then is worse. And so that net effect means the current estimate of how much income there is in the economy today is about one percentage point lower than it was before. And so that's problematic. A, the slowdown in income growth is problematic in and of itself. This is probably one big economic indicator that's not looking so good today. and makes us concerned moving forward. What does this slowdown mean? A lot of it has been tied to the loss of manufacturing and oil and gas-related jobs, but it's broader than that. We're seeing it in a lot of sources of income, too, across all different components of personal income tax collections at the same time. So it's problematic, but again, it's impacting our forecasts. So we're flagging it here. It's feeding through to some of our models. Where that jump-off point, what is the last point of history, say, how much income there is in the state of Oregon, is a little bit lower today than what we thought it was previously. And so that's just an issue, and this is probably the one big indicator out there that's not flashing a green light for the economic expansion. With that, we'll move on to the labor force and in the tight labor market. This is just a chart. Instead of showing you that the unemployment rate's really low, this is just showing you the amount of available Oregonians per job opening in the state, right? The businesses are trying to hire. They're saying it's more difficult to find workers today than it has been in recent years. This shows you there's about 2 people in Oregon per job opening that are probably available for work. This includes both the official unemployed and those that are out of the labor force entirely that probably should be back in it if we were in a stronger economy, if we were back in, say, the 1990s, looking at the compositional change of the workforce or the population, it just shows that we're tight, right? And so the increase in difficult to fill positions is really across the board here in the state of Oregon. It should be pointed out that a good chunk of those business openings, job openings from businesses that they say they can't find workers, are for reasons tied to the job itself, right? They say they have low wage, they're odd hours, they're in geographically isolated areas, things like that that are hard, that make them difficult to fill. That said, there has also been an increase in just a general lack of applicants, and that goes back to the tight labor market. And so that's what we're getting at here. If we want to continue, as Mark was saying, growing at these really strong growth rates, what do we need to see? How are we going to get more labor into the economy to sustain these, you know, growth rates of 2-3% job growth instead of trailing off down to 1%, which is more along the lines of the working age population growth, something like that. And so there's 2 real sources where this can come from. The one we'll talk about now is labor force participation rate. I don't know if you want to do this one.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Okay. The first one is we can get more labor out of the existing workforce today or the existing population. The larger share of the Oregonians currently here can say they have a job or they want a job and they're actively looking for work. That is the red line. It's measured as everyone that's 16 years or older in the state. That's the way this measure is calculated. And you can see it's down over the last 20 years. A lot of this decline, or at least half of this decline, if not more, is due to the aging of the baby boom population into their traditional retirement years, right? Again, it's calculated as everyone's 16 years and older. There's no cutoff at 60 or 65 or 70 years old or whatever the case may be. And so even if the economy was operating at full capacity, like we saw in the late 1990s, the labor force participation rate would have declined substantially in and of itself just due to the demographics. That said, the decline has been more severe and steeper, and particularly tied around recessions, than the aging of the population alone would suggest. So that's all that dotted line tries to show, is that it should be going down just due to demographics, but it's gone down a lot more than it has before. In recent years, you can see the red line started going up. We've had a labor force response. As we've gotten more jobs, as wages have risen per job, we've seen more people come off the sidelines and come back into the workforce looking for these more available better paying jobs that are out there. And so we've gotten a good response. It's just we're not all the way healed. Labor force participation rate is still somewhat lower than it should be relative to a stronger economy. And the question is, okay, if how much of this is permanent damage? People have become discouraged over 20 years and they're not going to come back. What are the reasons why people aren't in the labor force? And so the next chart tries to answer that. Here, we're focusing on what are called the prime working age population, 25 to 54 years old. This, historically, we're talking 90-95% of these folks are in the labor force. 85-90% of them have a job, maybe a little bit lower than that. 80-85% have a job historically. And outside of being in the labor force, they don't do a whole lot of other things. But that said, the reasons why they're saying they're not having a job or looking for work today have increased across the board. This graph looks at the change over the last 16 years from 2000 prior to the tech downturn through the most recent available data last year in 2016. Why aren't you looking for work? everything is up across the board. The rise, the increase in the bars is the percentage point increase by response rate. And you can see, again, everything is up. And we've kind of ordered them from left to right on those most likely to come back into the workforce if they get the right opportunity to those least likely to come back into the workforce. And so with the first couple categories, it makes some sense, right? We have some discouraged workers. People gave up looking for work because they couldn't find one. Well, now that the economy is doing considerably better, job openings are increasing substantially, they can find a job most likely. It might not be the perfect one. It might have some skills mismatch, some other things going on that can be problematic that you'd have to do significant efforts to make that work. But that said, those people can come back into the labor market when the economy is stronger. Same thing with the increase in schooling. We saw big increases in higher education enrollment during and after the recession. There was no job opportunity, so it made college look even more attractive in and of itself. Than it does typically, given lifetime earning projections and all that sort of stuff. Eventually, you do graduate from school, right? It might take you longer time if you're doing it part-time than full-time, but eventually you do graduate, or maybe the opposite would be you drop out, but you do come back into the labor force. So getting these people back into the economy seems to be a pretty reasonable thing. So another percentage point, maybe 2 percentage point increase in labor force participation among these prime working age population is not out of the question. We've seen a lot of it come back. We can still get a little bit more. You start to move beyond those first couple of categories, it starts to get a little bit harder to project. You get into the gray areas, the decisions, particularly when it comes to stay-at-home parents. You know, what happens if childcare being so expensive, if we could do something around that, maybe we could get more moms back into the labor force. Or maybe an opening comes up at the childcare center in your neighborhood, right? So it's easier to pick up and drop off your kids. The logistical things like that make it easier to have a job too. Things like that will impact the decision of being in the labor force and having a job or not, right? We think of it as a black and white decision, but it really operates on a continuum, right? What if you got $2 more an hour, maybe $10,000 a year more for a different job opportunity? Yeah, then I would decide to put my kids into daycare and come back and have a job. The other one that we've talked about is the big increase in those claiming they are too ill, they're in bad health, or they're disabled, and so therefore they can't find a job. This is something that we've been struggling with for quite some time. We're not entirely sure what it means. Some of the big possibilities it could be would be we have an outright public health crisis. These people responding to these surveys where people are knocking on their door asking, why don't you have a job? They're saying, I am literally too sick to be able to work. That's one opportunity. One could be a broader social acceptance of pain, right? Do you just admit today that you have a bad back and you can't work or something like that, whereas previously you wouldn't respond as such? There could be just a shift in societal responses to surveys. Another one could be saving face. You lost your mill job and you do have a bad back, and you're working construction and you were laid off during the downturn and you can't find that same job. That same job no longer exists, and so you're responding and saying, well, I have a bad back, and you're saving face to a certain degree.
Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Chair. Can you explain the X and Y axis here? I'm trying to make mathematical sense of, you know, it's 0, 1, 2, 3%, and then you go across. What is the percent of what here? Because you only add up to about 10% here.
Correct, because the labor – okay, so Chair Barnhart, Senator Boquist, the labor force participation rate itself is down somewhere in the neighborhood of around 10 percentage points. Okay. And right. So you add all these together and you get that total, right? And so this is decomposing that big change into the smaller components of it.
And follow-up, could you just, if you know, give us an example of what does 1% mean in real numbers here in Oregon or one of these categories here? I mean, it's great to have a chart that, you know, looks dramatic, but it's like, okay, what does this mean in English?
We're talking how many millions are in the labor force?
Two. Right. What is 1%?
It's 4 million in population.
What is the working age?
There are 2 million.
Yeah.
There's 2 million. 200,000.
In consultation, we're estimating that about
25 to 54 year olds is the thing. So
it's roughly half of the population, roughly speaking. So 1 percentage point of 2 million is 200,000. So each percentage point here is very, very significant.
Okay.
Right. So every percentage point of labor force participation is a huge number in terms of the available workforce.
Yeah, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a deep compassion for each and every one of the folks who want a job or enrolled in school, have a home or family issue or other, or ill or disabled or retired. But I keep hearing you use the word saving face. Does saving face mean not telling us the truth?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, in essence, to a certain degree, right? You know, someone's asking, why don't you work? And the real answer is, well, my mill job went away and I can't, my skills don't translate to the current economy. And that's a hard thing to talk about, right?
And here's where I'm going with this, yeah. Mr. Chair. And again, I have a voting record of supporting these programs. But I think if you talk to a lot of average Oregonians as they're spending a Saturday morning at Walmart, they're going to tell you, no, this is garbage. There's people who could be in the workforce who are not. And they may be judgmental. Who knows what the circumstance is? Maybe they are enrolled at school. But there's a perception among many that the truth is not being told, and folks who could work are not. And I wonder if you have a comment about that.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, that's the question, right? And I think that could be part of it. That's one of those options, right? Is it a public health crisis? Is it just a change in societal response rates to surveys? Is it people not telling the truth? Another one would be the increase in the disability enrollments, right? Are people receiving benefits? And so we looked into this, right? We're trying to figure this out. This survey doesn't tell you the exact reason. This is just someone telling you why they're not working. And when it comes to the disability enrollments themselves, they're up, once you adjust for the population, they're up maybe half a percentage point, right? So this increase in the ill or disabled is up 2 or 3 percentage points. 0.3, 0.4% of that maybe is a legitimate increase in those actually on the disability roll. So it is one factor. It's not the major driving factor in terms of those who are actually receiving disability income. And so those are kind of the options that are out there, at least in the way our office is, again, is it a public health crisis? Is it a change in the way people respond to surveys? Is it people not telling the truth? Or is it actual people that are on disability insurance? We don't have a good answer beyond that. Now, we're also seeing a corresponding increase, not to the same magnitude, because these numbers are huge, right? A percentage point is a very large number of people. But when it comes to the public health crisis possibility, we know we've seen a massive increase in very legitimate, serious drug addiction and overdoses, particularly around opioid use, right? And so there's been some new research in recent years coming from primarily from two economists out of Princeton, Ann Case and Angus Deaton, where they've kind of looked into this, and they're trying to figure this out. And a couple things here. They call it the deaths of despair. These are things where people are dying of drug overdoses, alcoholism, and suicide. Massive increase, particularly among white non-Hispanics, both men and women. This chart shows you men for 45 to 54 years old, but it's across all age cohorts, and it's primarily among whites, less so among various communities of color. Not that other ones don't suffer from these afflictions at the same time, but the increase over the last 15 years is primarily among whites and lower, you know, those without a college degree in particular. A couple points here about this new research. As we have some stuff coming down the pipeline in the next few months. We haven't written up a report, but it fits right in with this issue of the increase in those that are too ill or disabled to work, and what does that mean for the economic outlook? It's not just about the opioids. Here in Oregon, we've actually done a pretty good job of stemming the tide of opioid-related drug overdoses with the increase in Naxalin, the life-saving medicine that can revive people. Our opioid deaths by themselves have really stopped rising for the most part, at least relative once you adjust for the population, unlike in other states. And so when you look at things like the Trump administration's commission for opioids, the report that they just put out, one of the things they recommend at the federal level is to make this Naxalin much more readily available. Well, we've already done that in Oregon for years now, and that has helped. But again, this research tends to show is that this increase in bad outcomes due to drugs, alcohol, and suicide among white Americans is really an outlier amongst the developed world. It's going down for a lot of Hispanics within the country. It's going down in Germany and France and Sweden and England, all these other places in Europe. It's continuing to go down in terms of mortality. The lifespan is getting longer. Well, it's not for white Americans. And so why? What is pushing back against that? You know, lung cancer is going down. We're having these big historical shifts in the health of the American population. Except we have this. We have these types of things pushing back against those long-run trends in life, longer life expectancy. And again, it's much broader than just the opioids. That's getting the focus today, the heroin, the painkillers, the fentanyl, and all that sort of stuff. And again, this is outside of our wheelhouse, the public health stuff, the detailed of the medical market. But it's feeding back into the economy. And when it comes to talking about labor force participation and what are these people doing with their time instead of being in the labor force, we can tie it back in. And again, it's coming from some relatively new economic research. And again, it's not fully fleshed out, but we're working on this in the near future.
Yeah, I have three in the queue, and I think we'll just go through them quickly. One of the things I note is that we've had a chance to rest a little from session, so now we're back to being fully engaged. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can't count the number of calls I received from local employers asking me to get busy and find help for them, and they're paying far above the recently increased minimum wage, something close to $12 an hour, and they can't find anybody to work. One of the suggestions that's been made by a local employer is that there be everyone's noticed that as the minimum wage went up, people would come in and ask that they work fewer hours so they wouldn't fall off whatever social safety net they might be utilizing. And so what my employers are now asking is that we would not take people off these safety nets and let them just please keep them working. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, a future discussion. But for what you guys are doing, the numbers that are super important, because these things are subject to being blown completely out of proportion. But anecdote to that is obviously the numbers. So I guess my question is, how would we put a measure on what I just described? People who see their wages go up and instantly quit showing up for one day of work, so because they don't want to wait, they're happy to work less, earn the same amount, not fall off the safety net. Where do we get the numbers to show that kind of element of what you're presenting here?
Is that another way of asking, can we study this issue?
Well, yes, if we, I can't, and I don't, I expect the answer today. I just want to make sure we get it so we can place the reality of it in front of people. So maybe it's thousands that are doing this. Maybe it's 16 people. I don't know, but we sure would like to.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, this is something that I know the executive branch, budget and management, has looked into in recent years. It's really gets complicated fast because there's so many programs, right? You know, and nobody or hardly anybody signed up for every single one of these benefit programs. So you pick some case studies and try and talk about that benefits cliff where you get your income going up and then you lose your you lose your benefits. And that's something that policy struggles with considerably. It's my understanding that we've smoothed out that benefits cliff pretty well here in Oregon. That's something that came out of this research. There's a couple ones where we've had some issues with maybe the work-related, child-related daycare maybe has a cliff in it, but some of the other ones don't. And so even though you're getting an additional dollar from work, you're not losing a perfectly corresponding dollar of benefits. You're maybe losing a partial, right? Maybe you're losing 50 cents or 60 cents. You're getting a dollar more from labor income, but you're losing 50 cents on the dollar from the benefits. So on net, you're still getting better overall, but that's also a big issue, and it's a really hard thing to get away from because you want the safety net to be adequate. Sometimes you want it to be generous to make sure people don't fall completely off the cliff. But then as you come back, if you look at things like the marginal tax rate, again, if you're getting a more dollar of labor income, and as an example, you're losing 50 cents of benefits, that's a marginal tax rate of 50%, which is huge, right? There's in and of itself, it's really, really hard to get away from a situation where that exists unless you make that smoothing ramp from benefits to no benefits really, really long and really, really gradual. That's the only way to get around it, but then that costs a lot of money.
So, follow up. Well, I just want to say, what I'm saying is real. This is happening.
Yeah.
Now, I would like to know how much of it's happening. It's just to try to keep it, because I understand completely the complexity of the issue. I truly do. But if there was some way of getting a measure of how much of this is happening, perhaps that would make us more likely to try to do something when it comes to addressing the complexities.
Right. We only have a limited bandwidth, and the question is this a big one or a little one?
That's the question.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say to what Representative Bench was saying, when we were looking at the minimum wage in the last session, this whole discussion about the benefits cliff was had in a work group, and we should probably dig up that PowerPoint or ask the people that did that for us to come back, because we talked about where's the cutoff, you know, what is the wage increase. I'm trying to remember. It was probably somebody from the employment department that sort of threw all this together. It'd be interesting to see, because there was a lot of discussion about that benefits cliff. I would just also point out the comment that I wanted to make before I riffed on that was, there was a thing in the New York Times about how part of the problem with older, white, mostly male Americans who are not in the workforce is the jobs that are being created don't necessarily match their skill set, and so they don't necessarily want to go back and learn to be a CNA or an LPN or become a nurse, because that's not a masculine career, that's not what they were doing. And they're older, or they don't want to become a coder, and they don't want to move. You know? I mean, that's, you know, like some of those things require picking up and going somewhere else where, you know, where the employment is moving to, and that's part of the problem as well. And this was a broad article, it wasn't just focused on Oregon, but that was a discussion in the New York Times.
Senator Boquist?
Thank you. I'd like to go back, and I don't think either Josh or Mark has the answer, but maybe they can get the answer, or some member of the committee might know and can get it, but no, stay on the same slide. We talked about opiates. I mean, suicide and mental health care is like epidemic proportions. If you look at opiate issues, it's epidemic proportions. But what I think I heard said in comments by members is that 122% number that's in the upper right-hand corner is actually because we're treating the symptoms, meaning we have drugs that prevent them from overdosing, that if we didn't have that drug, that number, even though it's epidemic and in the top four in the nation, would be significantly higher. Is that what I'm hearing? I mean,
Chair Barnhart, Senator Boquist, that is one possibility. We started digging into the right, what exactly is causing it. It's up across the board. It's drugs and it's alcoholism-related liver disease and whatnot, and it's suicide. So it is broader than that. It's kind of hard to tell because we don't have much detail on what these individuals' lives were like, right? And this is only one statistic. What is that final thing that ends your life, right? Everything that led up to that point where you could be addicted to drugs, but then you die in a car crash and you'd show up as a car crash related death, right? And so that's a hard thing to know. We see them when people have jobs, and then if they drop out of the labor force, we don't really see them in any data necessarily. And then maybe this is a last resort. We see them back in the data here.
Mr. Chair,
yeah, please.
You're about 25% of the mark here. The question I'm asking, and I don't think you know the answer, but maybe a member does and can get back with me, is that what I thought I heard is while we're at record opiate overdose and deaths in Oregon, we have done medically a good job of saving them before they die, in a nutshell, through a whole variety of medical reasons,
yeah.
Which means that 122% number and that epidemic we have for opiates is actually much larger. Understand what I'm saying? Much larger because we're saving them, which that's a treatment of the symptom, not a treatment of the problem. And I'm trying to grasp, if a member knows more than probably an economist, is that true medically? Are we really saving that many people, and is the epidemic actually much larger than what we think it is?
Let me make a comment.
And it's your realm, too.
Well, it is. And, I mean, I haven't practiced professionally as a psychologist for 17 years. But this slide just jumps out at me as a slide describing the epidemic of depression that probably arises out of the long time it has taken for us to recover from the recession. I mean, that's a pure guess. But if you, I treated people who were injured at work, And one of the key issues for them was not only the physical injury they had, but also the loss of self and the loss of the sense of capacity that led to depression, that made the physical pain worse, that made it harder to recover, that that led to their permanent disability. It's easy to think about them as malingerers, which is, I think, is one of the suggestions, and there probably are some, a few malingerers. But more likely, we're talking about people for whom there's a multitude of issues. I suspect that drug and alcohol, suicide, all of that is directly related to this big societal trend of hopelessness that came about as a result of the long recovery from the recession. I think it would be useful for us to know, and this may be, I can put this in the form of a question, what's happened in past significant recessions where there's been a long time recovering? Have we had situations that look like this, where we essentially lose a generation, or at least a part of a generation of people, because they simply can't adjust to the new circumstances, including the psychological explanation I'm making? I know there are others that are probably better, but that's the hit I had immediately when I saw this this slide.
Chair Barnhart and Senator Boquist, to get back to Senator Boquist's point, and I think Chair Barnhart is on to something, or at least that's where the Princeton research has gone to, is I think you're absolutely right. The epidemic and the number of users, drug users, is significantly higher than this. Here we're just talking about the number of people that have actually overdosed and died. And we bent that curve due to the medical policies in this state. Since around 2000 or so, this increase you see here over 15 years, well, this is a different chart than what I had. We've seen this increase over 15 years in particular. Well, since about 2010, we've bent that increased curve on the opiate overdoses, right, because we were able to revive them from a policy treating the symptoms point of view. That doesn't mean they stopped using. It just means they're no longer dying at an increasing rate. That's unique. Somewhat unique. I mean, we're not the only state that has done that, but if you look across the 50 states, most states continue to see this trend over 15 years. We've bent that curve. We haven't brought it back down, but it's the exact opioid overdoses have, as a share of the population, are no longer increasing like they are across the country. To Chair Barnhart's point, that is exactly where not from a psychology point of view, but from an economic point of view, they put forth the hypothesis that this increase is what they call cumulative economic disadvantage. Basically just meanings things got worse, and it's not just since the Great Recession. It was really since the 2001 recession. There's parts of this country, there's parts of this state that haven't gotten all the way back to 1990s levels of employment, right? Some people never recovered. Some parts of this state, some industries never recovered from 2001. That's one of the reasons why I don't think, as a big statement, 2007, we weren't fully healthy as economy in 2007, and then we had the legs knocked out from under us in a big way. And so it's really this 16, 17-year time period where we haven't been fully healthy as a U.S. economy, and in some parts of the country, not anywhere close to it. Here in Oregon, at this top line level, we're doing pretty well, but again, we still have lingering issues over 20 years now. And so, again, that's where this cumulative economic disadvantage hypothesis comes in, which I'm hearing at least echoed in some of Chair Barnhart's remarks.
Which makes it harder to find historical comparisons. This isn't a business cycle issue, it's a structural change. And what we're seeing in terms of manufacturing industries and some of the old line industries is, you know, doesn't have much of a precedent except for when we went away from agriculture years ago, and there may be something there.
Well, that's 110 years ago.
That's right. That's right. But this is really a big shift in terms of our industrial composition, and it does lead to skills mismatches. If you're a 50-year-old mill worker and the mill goes out and you're in a rural town, the mill goes away, that can be pretty devastating.
Thank you.
And that's why.
Senator Boquist, did you have another
one? One quick follow-up. Can you go back one slide? And I think, I mean, Representative Smith raised this issue, Representative Gnosis raised it, Representative Benson, we've all pointed, if you can even find a 1%, if you can fix 1% of that right there, that slide right there, just fix 1%, 200,000 new jobs as a tax committee colleague, do you know how much new revenue would come in? You know, how many more people would be employed? Do you know what the impact of the Oregon economy is? My district's the same way. I have $14 and $15 an hour jobs over in McMinnville that they can't fill because nobody wants to fill them. And as you note, that's well above the positions we have that are out there. Yet we have those numbers right there. Just one percentage point fix of that out of the legislature would be an economic boom to the state of Oregon.
Figure it out, and we'll do it. Yeah.
You're in charge, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bershinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I believe that there's a large majority of the people that aren't participating for one single reason. And my company has 15 job openings right now, and they start at $17 an hour. So we can't fill them. It's because they don't have to. For whatever reason, I don't know. They don't have to.
So thank you. I told you they were going to like that stuff.
Well, actually, we don't. We want it fixed.
Okay. So anyway, moving on. In addition to, again, tying it back into the economic outlook, again, I think Senator Boquist is right. 1% is a big deal here for us in terms of how much more steam we potentially have in this, in terms of the growing like we are now. One other way to get them, instead of just bringing them out in terms of more getting the existing labor force to participate at higher rates, is also drawing people in. And that's a way traditionally a lot of Oregon towns have done it. We have places like Benton County has traditionally always had the lowest unemployment rate in the state, maybe not right now, but over time. But it's because they're able to draw workers from outside of the county. Either that, or you could say no one wants to live in Corvallis if they don't have a job, but that's certainly not true. I spent a weekend in Corvallis, a very nice place. But at any rate, you can bring them in, but we have concerns in both a lot of our rural areas and our urban areas now about workforce housing and the availability of affordable housing, and is this going to start to put this constraint on? This is one of our biggest growth advantages in Oregon, our ability to attract workers from other states and add a discount. And so the concern is we're starting to hear, well, geez, I can't, some folks, you know, it's so hard to find housing, that this could start to put constraints on that. And maybe we're seeing it again. The population growth has really lagged in terms of the good census data, and we're still seeing strong rates of population growth. But some of our leading indicators are showing that maybe things are weakening. Perhaps our favorite here is the DMV records of folks who are surrendering out-of-state driver's licenses and want an Oregon driver's license. And you see this had reached an all-time high here earlier in the year, but appears to be maybe topping out at this point. And so that would be a further concern in terms of labor force or potential labor force growth. But that's at the heart of our outlook. And as I've said, you know, we just don't think that these 5,000 jobs a month gains that we were seeing a couple years ago are really sustainable, and given that we're starting to see some constraints on growth, in particular with the labor force. And so more along the lines of 2,000 or 3,000 a month would be compatible or consistent with the underlying labor force growth. So with that, that's sort of what we're doing to the economic and the revenue forecast too, which is kind of like pulling it down a third in terms of the income taxes relative to what we saw in the peak of the recovery.
Excuse me, when you say pulling it down a third, you're talking about the growth rate?
The growth rate. We're continuing to expand just at a slower rate. And again, most also want to point out that still, even at this ratcheted down rate, it's still better than the vast majority of states in terms of the growth rates. We're still outperforming most states, even at this 2,000 or 3,000 jobs a month level, would likely still be better than most. And so we certainly saw better than most states here in the income tax collection season. We saw a really big end to our tax year. Here's our traditional quarterly tracking table that we need to put together in our report by statute. And as you see here, personal income taxes over the last quarter, which was the April through June quarter, right in that peak filing season, up 16% year over year. Corporate income taxes up 14.5% year over year. And that's for the corporate income taxes. That was coming after a string of really rapid declines. It all of a sudden turned around sharply at the very end of the biennium. And personal income tax, although we expected it to be pretty good, when I came here in May, we were saying 11 or 12%, ended up being even better year. You know, 16% year over year is a pretty good one. So that So that put us solidly into kicker territory. At the time in May, we said we had about a 2 out of 3 chance of having a kicker. Well, this certainly had that realized. It also creates a little bit of potential for maybe stronger numbers than we expect next biennium, and particularly this next month or two, which is the extension filing season. For folks who have extensions or amended returns, these are typically complicated returns, often our wealthiest taxpayers at the end of the year. To what extent does this real strong payments that we saw in April and May is going to translate into strong payments in September and October? It is an open question. We still have quite a lot left. The Department of Revenue has gone ahead and processed most of the returns in terms of matching them to past years and whatnot. We've got about 95% of the returns processed, but there's still these 5% of these extension filers out there yet to be returned. But of those 5%, in a typical year, that's about 40% of our capital gains. So for the capital gains forecast right now, depending on what the timing looks like, if it looks like 2015 or 2010 or 2012, it's going to be somewhere in between $9 billion and $6.5 billion by the end of the season. So that's a big potential shift, and we do have some upside there. But I'm not too worried about having a relatively low forecast, because there's also behavioral effects going on, and these are things that a lot of folks tell us are certainly real. And in particular, it's anticipation of the federal tax environment. And this makes a huge difference for a lot of investment-type income and when you choose to realize it. We saw this a couple years ago when the Bush tax cuts were expiring, that Oregonians in mass pulled forward their investment income to try to get ahead of this tax increase. Well, now, by all accounts, the opposite is happening, that a lot of people are expecting some kind of rate cut over the next year or two at the federal level, and therefore are postponing realizing some of these gains. So I think a low forecast is certainly defensible. That said, such a big end year, and since there's so much uncertainty out there, a lot of things, I suppose, are defensible. So it did push us into the kicker. So a quick refresher. The kicker base was set in May of 2015. We gave the forecast 2 years ago when the legislature was in session, and then added on the legislative changes that were made at that time that brought in more revenue and set the base for the kicker there somewhere at $16.9 billion. For the personal income tax kicker, that's everything but corporate income taxes in the general fund. We call it the personal income tax kicker. It's mostly personal income tax, but it has other stuff in it too. This time, that was a big deal, and particularly the estate tax missing by $100 million was a big component or factor here. But as you see here, if then 2 years later we come in above that 2% threshold, we return not only the excess but all of that down to the closed session forecast, that extra 2% as well. And so that's what creates the discontinuity and the difficulty from a policy management perspective. Is that it's not a smooth change in revenue. It can happen pretty drastically. The intuition there was that the sense of it is that, well, you know, if the legislature was able to pass a budget with only $16.9 billion, well, then they don't really need any more than that, and so we can take it all away, if you know, all of the unanticipated revenue away. And so it creates this discontinuity, and you see here a kicker where we're projecting now at $464 million, which is 2.7% over the kicker threshold. The personal income taxes were 2.3% over the threshold, so relatively close to the threshold. It's still a forecast that, given our historic forecast errors, is still a relatively good one, but nevertheless, it's not good enough to be under the 2% threshold, and therefore out goes another kicker in the next tax period, which begins here. People start paying at the beginning of 2018. So So how is that going to be paid out? Well, this time we finally have a little bit of information on that. Last time was the first time that we had a kicker that was paid out as part of the, or the first time in years, that was paid out as a credit on your tax form instead of a check at the end of the year. And so now, given the pattern of how those went out in 2016, we can try to guess what's going to happen in 2018 when people are filing their next taxes to calculate. So here's where we get. It's like a rebate for taxpayers, a rebate on your 2016 taxes. We're saying basically if you paid 2016 income taxes in Oregon, you're going to get 6% of that back. And it's going to come through, you know, it'll be a line item on your next taxes. And so for most people, or over half of that, $464 million is going to come in terms of a check, just like the maybe smaller than it used to be, but a check for a refund, cash in hand. Then a smaller chunk are people who are just going to or who owe personal income tax to the state, and they're just going to apply it to that. And then smaller pieces, folks that decide, oh, you just hold on to my refund and apply it to next year's taxes or the year after. So these have lasting effects, and then these others, this last $10 million, which are offsets. We call them offsets, but these are if you owe the state for any range of reason, child support or court fines or other kinds of taxes like corporate taxes or the like, or personal taxes from old years, the Department of Revenue goes ahead and keeps your kicker money for that as well. These are significantly lower than they were in the world of everyone gets a check. We're starting to see lower amounts of these offsets because some of the folks don't file or don't have resources, you know, that are here. And so create this when we gave a kicker check to every taxpayer, there was a kicker check to claw back for every taxpayer. Now we're not necessarily the case, so this is much lower. And so this, I'm not sure how this affects the overall cost savings argument for going to this tax credit. There was a big cost savings on the interest side. Back in a decade ago, we had a $1.2 billion kicker, which had to be paid out as a check in December, which is the same time we have a double school payment and we haven't got our income taxes in yet, so there's a cash flow problem. Mm-hmm. So we had to borrow $1.2 billion to pay out, and that has a significant millions of dollars worth of interest costs to carry over. So at different interest rates, that can be more bigger or smaller than the losses in these offsets that we experience. Mm-hmm. And the other issue is with these offsets, we don't know if they're all losses. Right, it may be that I'm going to pay my child support next month or 3 months from now, but you get it today because of the kicker, but I was going to pay it anyway. And so that's not really a net gain to the state, it's just a timing issue. So that's how it's going to flow out over the next couple of years, and that's already pulled out of our baseline revenue stream. In terms of the size, again, as a rebate on your 2016 taxes or something like that, the size of that rebate is going to be a function of how many taxes you paid in 2016. And our personal income tax does, you know, exhibit, although it's not particularly progressive in terms of rates, it is with the 9.9% now with our Measure 66 rates. But nevertheless, you know, just the fact that higher incomes pay more taxes means that these are the folks that are going to get the largest kicker checks. And in terms of this impact, in terms of stimulating the economy of checks like this, you know, they do have a higher per dollar impact the more you give to lower income households, because lower income households spend a higher share of their income immediately and are able to save less. And so this is very much funnels back to some of our higher income households relative to the lower income ones in Oregon. That does, you know, so how do we filter this into the economic outlook? Not really much. The only place where we're really probably going to put a direct impact is on video lottery sales, which peak right around the tax refund season typically, and so we're going to go ahead and add a little boost for that.
Should we get it back?
That's interesting.
I had a bill, I think last session, that would have changed the kicker from an amount based on taxes paid in the previous year to a per head basis, which would have meant that, I assume, would have meant that each person would have gotten in the neighborhood of $90. Maybe a little different than that, but
Probably more like the average. Right?
The average is $227. Okay, $227. That would have had a different impact on the economy, wouldn't it? My assumption is that high-income people, if they end up with a $5,000 check or a reduction in their taxes, they just simply leave the money in the stock market rather than spending it.
Yeah, and so for the immediate impact of putting a dollar in everyone's hands is going to be, it is higher when you give it to low-income folks and high-income folks for the exact reason that you stated, that high-income folks save some share of their income and spend some share of their income, whereas low-income folks spend most and save a small share. And so you get more bang for your buck when you do spending programs towards lower-income folks. It's less clear on the incentives for labor and the incentives to earn income. Right, and so we don't know exactly, if earners factor in the kicker when they're deciding how much they're going to work today, because I might get a kicker and what's my rate. Obviously, that's pretty complicated, but nevertheless, part of the economic drag depends on, are we taxing productive folks or unproductive folks, and the more you put taxes on productive people and capital, that's a drag, and so there will be some playback there on the taxing side, but it's really hard to point to how much.
Thank you.
So I probably, for the sake of time, I'm going to skip this. I know how much Chair Barnhart loves informational sessions. We have a really goofy accounting thing. We have a beautiful accounting system, cash-based in Oregon. Almost everything is clean except for this goofy thing that they put in the DAS director put in the 1980s to drum up some money, and we can't get rid of it, and it's a pain. So I was hoping that legislators could figure this thing out. But
take care of this.
At any rate, we'll save that for the next time. Right. We are seeing slowdowns across income. Our withholding has slowed some. Still, again, much better at 6-7% year over year. Much better than the typical state. But clearly slowed down, and particularly at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, when we saw the overall personal income dip. So we are seeing that come to pass as expected, and we're really seeing across, now that we've processed most of the tax returns, we've really seen a slowdown across different kinds of income here. You see the investment income, business income, work income, retirement income, all kinds of retirement income from pensions, IRAs, Social Security, all of these things are slower in 2015 than they were in 2014 and slower yet again in 2016, all except for interest, where we finally started to see interest rates tick up.
Excuse me, when you say slower, what you mean is growth rate is lower than it was before, if I understand that correctly.
Yes, absolutely. I'm
sorry. So it's still going up, but it's not going up as fast.
Yeah, I should always point that out. For example, total income here in Oregon, you see in 2014 was going up almost 9% year over year. Now we've cut that growth rate in half to about 4% year over year. Again, better than the typical state. Still going forward, still healthy growth, but something more sustainable, not like the peak of the recovery that we saw. And so that's a little bit of a concern, that retirement in particular has been underperforming our forecast. I think a lot of it had to do with people accelerated their retirement in the early stages of the recession, started cashing in some of these IRAs and pensions, and took away from the amount that's out there to be realized. Another interesting facet is, while I showed you last time All of our pass-through income of all kinds is growing really rapidly in recent years, whether you're a, you know, whatever, a S-corp or an LLC or you know, partnership or proprietorship, all these things are going up, you know, at a lot. But you see the increase in Schedule E stuff, the rent stuff and the proprietorship and basically the things that were in part given a beneficial tax rate by the pass-through income in the special session 3 years ago are doing quite a bit better than the proprietorship. So we're not really seeing the shift that we expected to the places with one employee to go ahead, you know, to be increasing while we pull down on the proprietorships as businesses change their filing status. We really haven't seen that much of a shift, but there certainly is a shift going on, or at least in terms of much stronger growth in the tax-advantaged category. So there may be something going on there. We don't know if it's economic. It's not necessarily job creation. It may just be folks changing their business structure in order to take advantage of the tax rate, but doing the same amount of business. But so in general, looking forward to the 2017-19 biennium, we have a small increase in overall resources relative to May. That red section, which also, of course, carries forward into the September forecast, is the legislatively adopted actions, about $135 million in tax increases the legislature passed here a couple months ago, $57 million in spending reductions, and then a few million, 30 or 40 million in lottery administrative savings and fund sweep. So overall, we're pretty steady with that. We have a little bit of an increase.
Excuse me, Representative Smith.
I think, Mr. Chair, as the vice co-chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out to all committee members that what goes up also comes down. And while this is up, we should be preparing collectively, jointly, to be prepared for that number in the future to come down. And at some point in time, we're going to have to realize that many of the dollars that we've spent on priorities, education, healthcare, economic development, transportation, we may not have that level of resources in the future. And I think we just need to be cognizant of that. Thank you. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. Unfortunately, Revenue Committee, generally speaking, is very aware of these.
What's so interesting is your trends. Ways and Means Committee isn't. and this will be an issue very shortly.
Yeah, I'm all for pointing out the fact that this forecast is very uncertain and likely to be very wrong. Maybe up, maybe down, but yes, please don't hold it against me when they do come in lower.
But never uncertain.
So relatively steady. A lot of that's coming from the lottery. Here I decomposed the changes in the forecast relative to May. And so for the current biennium, we ended 15-17 with this big run-up in corporate and personal income taxes, and you see that there, which gave us about $100 million in extra unanticipated revenue for the 15-17 biennium. But now heading into 17-19, we've pulled back on that. The other bar there, that's where you see the legislative enacted changes. That was the role of the legislature. But that $105 million up that's offsetting our declines in personal and income and corporate income taxes, personal and corporate income taxes have been pulled down in part due to the kicker and also in part due to a lower profit forecast. But this has been more than offset by an increase in this lottery forecast, and Josh will talk a little bit about that. And again, that's related to our overestimating the drag that the Cowlitz Casino would create when it was opened. But going forward, those lottery increases persist throughout the outlook, but so too do the declines in personal and corporate income taxes. On the personal side, a weaker inflation forecast is to blame, and on the corporate side, it's the weaker corporate profits forecast that we're getting from our vendors.
Now, again, are these real declines or are they simply changes in the rate of growth?
Again, I'm sorry, Chair Barnhart. These are changes in the rate of growth. Most all of these are increasing. Not every line item is increasing in 17-19. I'll talk a little bit about that. We have some flat corporate. We don't have a lot of growth in lottery, estate, things like that. But yes, the general fund is growing. Expected to continue to grow, and most elements of it will continue to expand.
The reason I keep asking this question is because your graphs are almost always related to a previous forecast, and in the previous forecast you had predicted growth, and so given that your rate, your comparison isn't with real dollars, mm-hmm. it's with your prediction from before, you almost have to ask, are we still talking about growth, or are we talking about a real decline? And I think every time you, so far at least, you've said, no, we're still talking about real growth, just not as fast.
That's correct. I really need to work on my language as well. I sometimes use the terms like flat and unchanged interchangeably, and that doesn't necessarily matter. Mostly what we're focused on is like you say, this delta, the change in resources available to the legislature. Do we have more or less than we did 3 months ago than we said we did 3 months ago, not necessarily whether that's more or less than last biennium. But this graph does show you the biennial revenue growth. And I did want to make a couple comments on it because you see what we're talking about in terms of this downshift in 17-19. So these would be actual growth rates. So yes, in next biennium, we expect somewhere around 5% total net revenue growth over the entire biennium, which is surprisingly slow or quite slow, but still, like I say, doing well relative to the typical state, but not like what we've become accustomed to by any means, but still expanding. But obviously this is a concern in our world of the kicker. If we get a year like we did, or a biennium like we have the last couple three, that would be a much larger kicker than we've been talking about here at the $464 million if we have things come out like that. But it's unlikely that they will come out like that for a couple of reasons. One being the personal income tax kicker is, of course, coming out of there. And then the second is the underlying personal income growth we have slowing down, along with argument with the job gains. And then for all these other types of revenue that are out there, a lot of them, what we call the cats and dogs, a lot of them are going to have a pretty flat outlook, at least what we're expecting. Estate taxes being a big one, Josh will talk about, and LRO is going to go into more detail after we speak. But that's way up at these historic high levels, so it's very difficult to put additional growth in and above where we're at historical high levels. The corporate income taxes are also a little bit high relative, or about coming down to where they kind of should be in terms of a trend, and so hard to put a lot of growth in there. Things like the lottery, while we've reduced the impact of the Cowlitz Casino, there still is an impact. So that's flat, so that slows down growth there. And likely, across the board, for a lot of these other revenue streams, we're really not, can't expect a whole lot of growth over the next biennium. When you add that to a kicker and a slowdown in personal income growth, you get this, a 5% biennium, which is really rare for Oregon, unless you're coming in and out of a recession. It's hard to get this kind of slow growth. So there is some concern that we will see stronger forecasts than this. But that said, there are some pretty valid reasons that we won't be able to get 15% year over year like we did this last biennium.
Real quick, a couple line items before we are finished with our prepared remarks. Estate taxes, this has been a forecasting headache for a few years now, where it has come in significantly above forecast. It contributed nearly a third, no, more like a quarter of the personal income tax kicker last biennium, because it was off by over $100 million relative to what we forecasted a couple years ago. And so we continue to peel the onion here, trying to figure out exactly what's going on. There's a couple things that are concerning about the estate tax forecasting. Again, Legislative Revenue Office will go into it a little bit more. We are getting more people meeting that $1 million filing threshold. However, Relatively speaking, even though these are the 1%ers or the 0.1%ers, and they have a lot of wealth, in terms of the tax revenue, that growth in the tax revenue is really amongst the handful of estates that have very, 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 very high levels of wealth. And so you can see that here basically in the red bars. Those people with the estates valued at $5 million and above at time of passing, the number of filers there is basically flat over the last couple of decades. However, the dollar values attached to those 40, 50, 60 estates a year has increased dramatically, 100, 200, 300%. So we're talking about a very few handful of estates with very high levels of wealth are where these big dollar swings have come from. And Mark talked about how we're at historic highs in estate taxes. We had a number of record level of states in the previous biennium. We can't necessarily forecast that we'll have, record estate valuations and a handful of very wealthy people pass away every year when it comes to records, but we do know the overall base level of wealth is back up to where it was in aggregate due to home values and stock markets and broader asset markets and things like that. So we have a strong estate forecast built in. It, at least for the last 3 months, it's no longer coming in above forecast. It's actually come in below forecast just a hair, which is better than we had seen in recent years. And again, Dr. Warner and LRO will talk more about that moving forward. Another thing that has been a forecasting headache in recent years has been the lottery. This chart basically just shows weekly sales here in Oregon in the dark blue line relative to last year in the gray line. And then the dotted blue line was what we expected to be the impact of the Alani Casino Resort, the Callis Tribe Casino up in Ridgefield or La Center, Washington, just across the border. It has come in, the impact of the casino when we met 3 months ago had been open for 2 or 3 weeks, and we saw no impact. Well, that immediately said, oh, that means our impact's off. But it's come through. We've seen an impact. It's coming in the magnitude maybe of 20%, a fifth of what we expected. So there has been an impact. It's just been significantly smaller than we expected. It's been significantly smaller than expected at every geographic level. We thought Hayden Island would get devastated, 40% declines in lottery sales. They're down 15%. Right, so significantly smaller. The rest of the Portland metropolitan area we thought would see small losses in sales as some of those dollars flowed up into the state of Washington. Well, the rest of the Portland metropolitan area is up slightly. And then the rest of the state is seeing strong growth or relatively robust growth, 4% year-over-year lottery sales outside of the Portland metropolitan area. So the forecast was clearly off. We're still working on decomposing what the issues were, how much of it is a fundamental forecast mistake, which I think is a lot of it, how much of it was some, we know the rollout and the opening of the casino itself was not without problems. You have the traffic congestion, you have the bridges acting as a bottleneck, you have, the lack of low-cost food options and a buffet, and there's lack of a hotel, so it's not a major destination. So these other things, we think the impact will grow necessarily over time. We don't think after 3 months a brand-new casino is finished in terms of where it's going to finally land. And so we've cut this estimate of the casino basically in half. Particularly when they get that next phase, and if they put in a hotel and things like that, I think we'll see a different dynamic. However, we have raised the lottery forecast roughly $70 million relative to what you guys built into the close of session because of this casino impact was off by a considerable margin. The only other thing I will point out is we weren't the only ones that overestimated the impact of the casino. The Spirit Mountain, the Grand Ronde, Confederate Tribes of Grand Ronde, their impact is coming in about 40% of expectations. They thought they would see 40, 41% sales declines. Well, they've seen 17% sales declines. So their forecast was more accurate than ours, but it was still off by a large magnitude at the same time.
Representative Ellis?
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, that I think, just like the eclipse, we didn't see the traffic problems that people were predicting. Maybe Oregonians just don't like to sit in their cars waiting to get somewhere. And, the traffic's bad in Portland. You can't get anywhere easily at any time of day. And so if you want to go out of state to gamble, maybe that's it. And it's like not worth it.
So perhaps you should talk to the people who passed the transportation bill and tell them to ease off on that congestion relief.
I don't think it's going to get so much better even with that. Just people are moving here, and they drive.
Yeah. For the record, that was a sarcasm on my
part.
Yeah,
I know.
Not a proposal. Yes, we did.
So speaking of the eclipse,
go ahead.
We threw our hands up in terms of the economic impact of the eclipse for most of our revenue models. We didn't know there's a there's a mix, right? We know we got a lot of tourists in town, so we're going to have spending on leisure and hospitality and stuff like that. But at the same time, we have this disruption that's like a snowstorm, and a lot of businesses shut down, you know, the local ones for a couple of days. So we didn't know how to balance that. But the one place we did put a bump in for the eclipse was in marijuana sales. So I think it's probably justifiable.
So we left the marijuana forecast relatively unchanged relative to 3 months ago. Again, this is our second quarterly forecast doing the marijuana forecast. We're comfortable with the baseline. We accounted for the legislative changes that were made during the session, and then we added a 10% sales bumps to August due to the increase in tourism. Other than that, there again, no fundamental changes to marijuana. We'll track how those go moving forward and adjust resources accordingly.
So my apologies for going so far over time.
Well, I wish I could keep a rambunctious committee more in order, but you had a lot of questions. Are there any other questions, colleagues, before we move on to the next? Chair Haas, please.
Thank you. I think you alluded to it somewhere along the line, but the cost containment measure that was passed at the end of the session, how did that factor in the forecast going forward?
Yeah, Senator Haas, we take those numbers straight from LRO and LFO and fold those in. So that's a $57 million estimate, I think, for the cost cutting on the LRO on the LFO side. I think it sums to 57.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else before we take a recess? Can we do it in 10 minutes instead of the 15 we had originally scheduled? Thank you. We'll recess for until 20 minutes after 10 and get on with the rest of our agenda. Thank you very much. And then committee stand. Committee will come back to order. Thank you all. We have three other items on our agenda, and we're going to try to get through all of them, and that means keeping questions to the ones that are the absolutely critical ones. And so we'll start with the review of the 2017 revenue measures passed by the Legislative Revenue Office. Paul?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, this is one of our best sellers. Comes out every at the end of each session. We have competitive prices. I think that helps our sales. But this is a summary of the revenue measures that were passed. It's a compendium of all our economists' work. Most of the bills are you familiar with that have come through the Revenue Committee, but some of them haven't. So we just want to include all of those things that we think had significant revenue implications. The main use I've always had for this report is historically, when you can go back to, okay, we looked at didn't we do something in 2005? And that's, so I think it's very useful for that kind of thing. We did go through and we organized it based on the subject area, so the economists are available to you for any questions that you have regarding those specific issues. I do put together an overview, and that goes through and ironically, I did put in a piece here talking about the labor force participation rate, so very consistent with what Josh had talked about. But there's also a review of the general fund close of session estimate and the ending balance of $195.3 million that goes in, that will be the starting point for the biennium, and that, of course, is increased with the September forecast. Finally, I just kind of go through and top and try to think about what are the most significant revenue-related bills, and the nominations I have for this session where the transportation bill, House Bill 2017, obviously a huge bill in terms of affecting the various aspects of revenue. House Bill 2391, which was the provider tax bill. It had several major components to it. I also did something a little unusual this time, and that is to put in the last version that the Joint Tax Reform Committee got to House Bill 2830-4, which was had the commercial activity tax and had various elements that you talked about. And obviously, of course, that did not pass. Usually we don't put something in that doesn't pass. But I think it's safe to say, and kind of the last sentence we put in there on this is that I think it's clear that this bill does represent, and I've been here this entire period, that it does represent the most detailed revenue reform plan the legislature has developed, you know, in committee and actually in bill form and language form and so forth. So in that regard, hopefully that will lead to some further help in looking at this issue down the road, and at least the various components. Senate Bill 28 was another one, which is the cost of performance and going to a market-based apportionment for intangibles. And finally, the credit bill was House Bill 2066, which had several components, so it didn't have the revenue impact you normally see with your credit bill, but that was also an indicator of the policy decisions that you made. So those are the ones, so that's for your reference and follow up on and let us know if there are any questions you have on any of those things.
Great bedtime reading. Are there any questions right now? thank you. How about status of state inheritance and estate taxes?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm going through real quickly. I have an article that Chris has just put up there from the Tax Foundation that came out in July of 17. One thing I did notice about this session, I think we had more bills relating to estate taxes than I can remember. None passed, but you had a number of them in each committee that were related to either indexing the brackets or going to the federal exclusion level, which is about $5.5 million, or just outright repeal, which is a number of states have done. The Tax Foundation report does a good job, I think, of going through and showing what the other states have done. They've really traced back the major declines we've seen in the estate tax since 2005, and those of you that were on the committee back then recall there was a real fundamental change in federal policy that went back to 2001, was phased in completely in 2005, that eliminated the credit that states could apply on their federal estate tax. So it was a no-brainer for states to have an estate tax. It was called a pickup tax. You had a certain percentage, and then you could use that credit. So the individual taxpayers weren't affected by the state tax. With that elimination, that changed the ball game, and the estate tax from the state standpoint stood alone. You had 49 states that had it in 2005. Now you're down to 18, and you can see them on the chart there. And you can see that Oregon and Washington are really the two western states that continue to have it, and there's a number back in the East Coast. One of the points that the Tax Foundation makes is this going to be a more competitive kind of atmosphere as opposed to the old pickup tax days when there was virtually no competition? So that's one of the things we're looking at. We're monitoring to see what happens with that. If you want to scroll down to Table 2 there, Table 1, that shows, it's on page 9 there. This gives you an idea how the estate tax rates vary for the individual states. And you can see that the three highest ones really are Massachusetts, Oregon, and Washington. Our effective tax rate is they have four levels of estate value. At $2.5 million, we have a $1 million exclusion. So we tend to have a higher effective rate at that lower value. As you get up toward the higher values, $20 million, for example, you can see Washington has the highest value among the states. Oregon's is about 13.5%. We have a 16% top marginal bracket, and that translates into a 13.5% effective rate for estates of $20 million. So that gives you a sense of kind of the lay of the land out there. This article does talk about an issue around the tax avoidance steps that are made, which are very well known in terms of estate planning, and goes through a series of them. And I think it's good reading for the committee to think about some of those. One of the things that we've asked the department to respond to is we see in a lot of the federal plans the possibility of a repeal of the federal estate tax, and to ask about what impact that might have in Oregon in terms of operating our current estate tax, and they'll have some comments for you on that. One thing that's interesting to me is we see a lot of these particular strategies, and they're laid out on in the Tax Foundation report beginning on page 20 and through 21, and things like gifts and transfers, for example, or shifting assets. these all are make sense from a rational standpoint, but yet we continue to see, as Josh pointed out, we continue to see strong estate revenue growth. So obviously not all of those estates are being protected from taxes fully. So there is definitely collections that are going on. And the last chart I like to show is that the graph I have, the individual graph, called Oregon and federal estate tax revenue. And this is kind of, this traces back the history of Oregon's estate tax. And actually, but prior to 1986, we actually had an inheritance tax in which it was the inheritors pay the tax based on the amount of value they have that they inherit. And that's based on your relationship to the person who's passed away. The closer the relationship, the lower the rate. You still see that in some of the states. We went to the pickup tax in the mid-80s. You can see the revenue drop. And we were expecting about $12 million a year, similar to what Josh and Mark were talking about. 91, 93, you can see the jump there. We had expected that revenue to continue low, and that was, in fact, when I did that forecast, that was my largest error, was in the estate tax. So we continue to get strong growth under the credit system. But you can see continued growth up into the $100 million range. And then you also can see from this chart what a huge blip we had last fiscal year. This is by fiscal year. So that's why they missed the forecast by $100 million, because it was literally doubled anything we had seen in the past. So, of course, the question going forward is, obviously we wouldn't expect this line to continue, but it looks like this is a revenue. It is a revenue source that looks like it will continue to be significant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many estates all drove that line up in 07, 16, 17? Was that 2 estates, 20 estates, 100 estates?
It was predominantly the estates were in that 5 million category. We don't have the real detailed on the returns. Christine's has data but doesn't cover that last year. We had 2 months in which we had payments over $40 million. So those are the months where we think there was 4 to 5 estates that contributed the majority of that.
Thank you.
So we do have some disclosure issues around that, too, as we look at individual estates. So, but this, you can also see the effect of federal policy in the 2008, the increase in the exclusion amount up to $5.5 million. So you can see that drop off in the federal revenue, but then it's now continued. It's indexed to inflation, but it's around that $5 million level.
And that's actually a much larger number, even though it looks like a smaller number.
It's in billions.
In billions, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're about 1%, so 1.5% of the federal total economy. Right. So that's kind of give you an overview of kind of the environment and how it's changed. Christine has some detailed numbers looking at Oregon's specific data, and this can get this doesn't have the most recent, but it gets into the question that Representative Vince raised about the distribution.
Mm-hmm. So, chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. Yes, here's more of a detailed breakdown of some of the distribution of the way that the estate tax is collected over various types of estate values. And the most recent years, we've also seen just an increase in some of the higher valued estates, and they were driving that spike up to the $200 million level. I have not actually reported on preliminary numbers for 2018, but it looks like they're, at least for the fiscal year, that the numbers are back down to kind of what previous years were, so 2014, 2015 levels in total, so around the $110 million mark. And it does look like that 200 was a bit of a blip. I think it highlights the variability that can happen with the estate taxes. One or two large value estates can drive this revenue, and it can be quite fluctuating depending on the type of decedents that die each year. And so sometimes even the larger values are clustered together. The most recent year in 2015, the 10 to 20 million category was reported together with the 20 million plus category in order to maintain confidentiality for the higher valued estates. There are 13 people in that category, or 13 decedents and estates in that category. So just stepping back to the next page, the estate, I just kind of outlined an estate tax by state that would actually show the 18 states remaining that have estate tax since 2005. That number's declined a lot since the federal pickup was done away with. So most of the states have quite a higher exemption amount from the Oregon exemption amount of $1 million. And the file there that you could look at is, it says Oregon and federal estate taxes. So the Oregon and federal estate tax revenue file is the one that shows, we're looking for that. If you, there it is. So, yeah, so this just shows kind of a detailed, a lookup table of the various rates. So there are, most of the states have a plain estate tax, and there's two states with a hybrid estate tax and inheritance tax. In all cases, there's also four states with with inheritance tax only. And the inheritance tax would vary with the relationship. In Kentucky and Maryland, the lineal heirs are totally exempt from paying the inheritance taxes. And that, the difference there is that it's taxed per individual who receives the piece of the estate and inheritance, whereas the estate tax focuses on the estate as a whole. But there are varying rates between the estate taxes and inheritance taxes. The highest rates for the highest valued estates, as Paul mentioned before, do occur in Washington State. Oregon's rates are 10 to 16%, but we have the lowest limit or exemption amount at $1 million. So estates above that value would start to pay the 10% rate. Some states have actually the exemption amount that's matched up with the federal limit, which is $5.49 million, and that's Hawaii and Maine. And then most of the states have an exemption amount, and also Delaware has that exemption of $5.49 million. Most of the states have some amount in between. Massachusetts also has the $1 million exemption, and it looks like the rate schedule's a little bit lower than Oregon's at the lower levels, but also has that lower level, and most of them fall in between somewhere. And so you can see the different amounts. Sometimes some states would start to tax the whole estate amount right over that limit. So if a state ended up being $100,000 over the limit, the whole estate would become subject to tax. But the vast majority of states with the estate tax, of the 18 states, they would tax just the amount over the exemption amount at a beginning rate, rather than having that real high marginal tax rate as soon as it gets over that exemption amount. So with that, Department of Revenue is here today to talk to us about the administrative concerns and some of the administrative aspects of the estate tax.
Great, thank you.
Hello, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Henderson, tax policy manager in the corporation and estate section at the Department of Revenue. Paul had asked to speak a little bit about the potential impacts to the estate administration of the estate program with the discussions of repeal of the estate tax at the federal level. Since going back to the fundamental federal change that Paul referenced in 2005 and the phase out of the pickup tax, ever since that time, Oregon's threshold has been disconnected from the federal filing threshold. The federal threshold has increased. So what would the impacts be to Oregon if there was a complete repeal? You can look at the basic facts document that LRO put out, I believe it was in the 2017 version. It talks about percentage of estate returns that come in and what percentage of taxable estate they have. You can see that from those facts, it shows that roughly 95-97% of the Oregon estate tax returns that are filed do not have a federal filing requirement. So what would the impacts be if the federal estate tax went away? 97%, it would kind of be business as usual. There is no federal filing requirement for those. Some things that would be some impacts to administration, I guess the compliance work that's done at the federal level for those returns of states that do have a federal filing requirement. There possibly could be some impact on voluntary compliance if folks somehow think that the federal tax has gone away now that the Oregon tax likewise maybe has gone away. Those are some potential impacts to the administration of it.
Questions, comments? I would simply note that if the federal estate tax is repealed, that's not the key issue for Oregon from the standpoint of revenue. It would be the repeal of the gift tax. That would be the key issue, because if the federal gift tax went away, then a great estate plan would be for wealthy individuals to alienate their property by a gift before their deaths, and thereby incur no Oregon tax because there's no gift tax in Oregon. I understand there's one state that has a gift tax, and that's Connecticut, if I remember right. But that's not an issue that we're going to have to deal with unless we have to deal with it. Anything else on this topic? Yes, Representative Vance, please.
Just one remark that, and I'm not sure this is a question so much as just a comment. The argument for the estate tax often is kind of a equity, equality. Those that have too much money should have some of it taken away when they pass away. And yet the $200 million number is an awfully small number when you look at the total amount of wealth that's being moved on. So I wouldn't suggest that that particular device is working all that well when it comes to income equality. In other words, I think if that was the goal of this particular tax, it's not working, at least at the state level, perhaps at the federal, given the billions. But it seems to me if we're going to have a discussion, and I hope we do, about broad tax reform, this would certainly be on the table.
All right. Thank you. Other comments, questions? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll go on to nonprofit property tax reporting options.
I'll turn it over to Kyle.
And Kyle, you're up.
Back on time. Okay, so good morning, respective chairs, members of both committees. Up next, or the last thing we have on the agenda today before the committees, is a discussion about the nonprofit property tax reporting options. And, of course, this is a topic that's been simmering for quite a while but has been in front of both committees for the last couple of sessions. We had a legislative work group. LRO did a background paper, and there's been some legislation I listed up there that didn't pass and some that did pass. And, of course, this is relating to property tax exemptions for nonprofit organizations. And there's, of course, the specific exemption that's causing the most administrative issue, if you will, and that's the literary, charitable, and scientific organization exemption, the 307, ORS 307-130. So there was some work done in the past session, Senate Bill 181, that was going to require some information return requiring or reporting from the nonprofits. It would have been an annual reporting requirement. That measure was in committee at the time of the adjournment signing die, so that didn't go through. The one measure that did pass was House Bill 3459, which made some adjustments to retail stores relating to thrift stores relating to animals, supporting animals. So that was an adjustment of the statute. But what we wanted to do today was just briefly touch on a couple of potential options, or really one potential option. So I listed three up there, which is you have the status quo, which is sticking with the statute the way it is and responding more or less to issues that come about. And again, the statute is pretty broad, and it's case law in many cases that determine how the statute is administered, what nonprofits qualify, what things they must meet in order to qualify for the property tax exemption. So that's number one. Number two would be work with an existing law, and then the third one was legislative changes. So what we wanted to talk about today briefly was the number two up there, work with the existing law. The thinking here is we're going to have a panel of representation from the assessors and the Department of Revenue, and they can explain a little bit of the work that goes on today in administering the exemption, and then also the different options that may be available working with the existing statute, which is, it's a broad statute, but the application requirements are actually pretty narrow in some cases. But in hopes of trying to set up, well, what could we do a little bit to tweak things to make it easier to administer today with existing law, and then what would require policy changes or law changes by the legislature. So today the focus will be on working with the existing law, and again, we have representation from the assessors and then also Department of Revenue that has general oversight responsibility of the property tax system, and then training as well for county assessors as well.
Great, thank you.
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I've been before most of you throughout this last session a lot. I'm just going to hit real briefly some of the issues we have with nonprofits and the qualifications of those. We've talked about it in session, so you're familiar with it. But in order to become tax exempt, an organization has to apply to the county. If they do not own the property, they have to apply every time their lease expires. So if it's a 2-year lease, 3-year lease, then every 2 or 3 years they would have to reapply for that exemption. We would probably not review that as closely as we would a brand new one, because we've already gone through the qualification process that I'll go through a little bit here that we look at for new. So they then just have to provide the application. They wouldn't have to provide their articles of incorporation and bylaws, things like that. But if they do not reapply, there is a late filing penalty, which we have people who just forget that they have to reapply, and we can collect a late filing penalty from them and then requalify them. So on new property or new organizations, we have to, like was discussed in Senate Bill 181, we have to go through and review that application first to see if the organization is incorporated and organized as a nonprofit organization. Do the articles of incorporation clearly state the organization's purpose? Do organizations articles of incorporation and bylaws require that assets be used for other charitable purposes upon dissolution instead of distributed back to the members? Does any rent saving inure to the organization? And this was just a new one that was passed. So before that, it was we had to review to see if the rent that was being charged was below market rent in an amount to offset the taxes. Now we will just look to see if the savings inures to the organization. The lease has to be an annual lease, and it has to be effective July 1st or prior, which means they have to be using the property as of July 1st in order to get the exemption. The organization must have charity as its primary, if not sole, object. And these are some of the court rulings that I'm getting into now that we look at. Is the organization performing in a manner that furthers that charitable object? Is there an element of gift and giving? Are the organization's activities for the direct good and benefit of the public and not for the benefit of the organization or the organization's members? So the members can't benefit from this organization and get a tax exemption. They can receive some compensation for their expenses, but they can't get any of the money back. Does the charitable activity relieve the government of an obligation to use tax dollars to accomplish the organization activities? This was one of the reasons that the Supreme Court theorized why tax exemptions were granted back in 1854, was the religious organizations and other organizations were relieving the government of having to use tax dollars to take care of people, to provide services to people, and they felt that they should, the way to offset that was to give them a tax exemption. And is the property actually and exclusively occupied or used by the organization to further its charitable object? So those are things that we have to look at on every new organization that wants a property tax exemption. So we usually, a lot of times we don't get all that information the first time through, and we have to ask for it if we believe that it's something that we need. Some organizations are very obvious that they meet the requirements. Others are a little more not quite so sure. We had a horse therapy, not therapy for horses, but adaptive riding therapy in Polk County, and they had applied for exemption. And we denied them the first year because it didn't appear that they were meeting the charitable criteria. But then the next year, after they'd been in business for a year or so, they had much better financial analysis, and we were able to grant that exemption. So it's something that we look at. We try and make the best estimates that we can, best guess that we can. And so it can be a time-consuming process for the assessor's offices. If you have any questions, I'll try and answer them. But we've talked about a lot of this stuff over the last 6 months.
Let's go ahead through the panel, and then we'll get to your question.
Chairs, vice chairs, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. As Kyle said, we were asked today to speak to what could be done under current law to address some of the concerns that the charitable exemption work group had as they were expressed in Senate Bill 181. Just real quick refresher, Senate Bill 181 would have required informational returns from nonprofits. Currently in statute, there's just a one-time application, as Doug discussed, and what Senate Bill 181 would have required is that many of the questions that Doug kind of ticked off there as he went through that list, many of those questions would be answered annually by the nonprofit. So 307-130 applications fall under statute 307-162, which is kind of a general application statute. 307-162 does not delegate policymaking to the Department of Revenue in any way, shape, or form. Any rule that we would make would be interpretive only, so we wouldn't be doing any kind of rule that would set policy. The 307-162 language for filing requirements is clear and unambiguous. It requires a one-time application that lists the property claimed exempt, to show the properties, how the property is used, and to cite the statutes under which the exemption is being claimed. So those are what basically you see on our form today. Any rulemaking that required any sort of annual filing akin to what Senate Bill 181 was trying to accomplish, we feel would likely go beyond the language in the statute, and we don't think that it would have a very good chance of withstanding any sort of challenge. So that does not seem a very likely a path for us. The Department of Revenue also has general supervisory authority for the property tax system under 306-115, and we kind of gave a little bit of consideration to that as well. But here you have a situation where there clearly in the statute is a one-time application, and we have other exemptions like the lease property exemption that Doug discussed, where you do have some more annual type reporting or reporting at the end of a lease, that type of thing. So we don't think that it would be appropriate for us to require any sort of annual filing under our general supervisory authority. So basically the long and the short of it is that if, as policymakers, you feel like the information that you were seeking in the information returns under Senate Bill 81, if you feel like that's valuable information, we feel like a statutory change is probably the best way to get to that sort of annual filing. Now, that being said, we will have the ability possibly to make some changes through our forms. We can maybe make some changes there. And then also the Department of Revenue does training for county assessors. And so with me today, I have Greg Kramer, who's one of our lead policy analysts for the property tax division. Greg comes from our finance, tax, and exemption team, which is the team of folks who answers the questions that come in from the assessors almost daily on exemptions and how to administer the exemptions. And Doug's going to speak a little bit about, Greg is going to speak a little bit about those forms and some of the training that we could maybe consider some changes to.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, Greg Kramer with the Department of Revenue. And yeah, there is an issue with the application process with the forms, and because there are three statutes that applicants can apply for under, depending on the lease situation, or if they're just the owner, the charitable organization is the owner of the property and user of the property. And the department has historically taken the approach of a separate form for each of those statutes, and they're somewhat all-purpose statutes because a number of the exemptions funnel through each of those respective exemption application statutes. And so I believe in the materials Kyle prepared, there was a cutout of one of those forms that showed that there are basically two questions, and that's about it, that comes on the application form. And the department is looking into that, especially given the Senate Bill 181 discussions, about how much additional or more specific questions we could put on those forms that might help the applicants get the right information to the assessor the first time, and possibly having portions of the forms or possibly different application forms for different exemptions under 307, 162, or 112, or 166. With the intent of trying to get the best information to the assessor the first time, so the assessor doesn't have to put workload into additional information. And also with respect to 307 or Senate Bill 181, and looking at that list of the information return information, I believe a lot of that information probably is based on case law, and it's just more specific ways of asking the taxpayer to provide the information. And so that probably would be within our scope of authority for, by and large, for a lot of that and those particulars in Senate Bill 181 to work those into the forms. We're looking into that. As far as training goes, just to touch on that a little bit, the department does provide training to the assessor's offices a couple times a year, depending on how workload works with other things that the staff is doing. And so there's a couple classes that we do around the state each year relating to exemptions. And we also have a technical work group that we try and hold a couple times a year with the assessor's staff, the exemption staff, particularly to find out what issues they're facing that year, what's come up that they haven't seen before, and also to discuss new legislation. And so we do go through those exercises as well with the counties and have discussions about those. There's also an exemptions manual, which is a big piece of work, and that's been in the process of being updated with new law and just to work in new case law as well. And so that we're trying to get that done by January, and so it'll be ready for this next filing season.
Bravo.
And that's all I had for now.
Thank you. Now questions. Representative Bershiger, or Senator Bershiger, thank you.
Thank you. Last year when we were going through our public safety levy conversations that were pretty heated, some of the things it brought up is we're seeing more and more of large land tracts being taken out because of nonprofits are buying these and for whatever they're doing. And some of these are timber tracts and ranches and stuff like that. And the other one that also surprised me is our largest building in the county is the hospital, and the hospital is out too. And so, you know, people were saying, you know, you want more money for public safety, but what about all these folks too? So is that a trend that we're seeing across the state, or is it kind of isolated to my little neck of the woods?
Chairs Hass and Barnhart, Senator Bershiger, we have not seen large tracts taken out of taxable status in Polk County. We've had a couple of applications, by the Nature Conservancy, that would have taken several hundred acres out, and I did not grant that because of the purpose that they said they were going to use it for. But we do have, I have heard from other assessors that there are large tracts being put into even conservation easements, which is a statutory purpose for farmland, forest land. that you can put it into a conservation easement. Even land that might have been on a market before could go under conservation easement. So it is an issue, and we did talk about hospitals in this last session. Kind of got bogged down. But I can't say from the association point of view that the taking of large tracts by nonprofits, but I do think it is happening more than it did, say, 10, 20 years ago.
Thank you.
Just to add to that, I'm wondering if the kinds of properties that the senator refers to come back on the tax rolls at some point. I mean, obviously, if it's a leased office and some for-profit business ends up leasing it later, then it would come back. But how about the kinds of lands he's talking about? Those are very unlikely to ever come back, aren't they?
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, that is correct. If it is a leased property for a nonprofit, for a retail store, something like that, yes. When they move out, it becomes taxable again. The ones that are purchased by nonprofits, say the Nature Conservancy or there's some forest groups, but a lot of times the forest groups will leave it under forest deferral so it doesn't come completely off. But those are usually in there for life, that they don't come out. We have seen Nature Conservancy selling off parts of their property, maybe to get more funds to buy more desirable property. But typically, it's when it's bought, they keep it.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you so much. We appreciate it very much. Thank you, colleagues. It was a great, good meeting today. We meet next time in September for legislative days. And I think we're meeting separately then, aren't we? Yes. All right, and anything else, Senator Haas? Anything else?
I think that's it.
Okay. All right. House Committee on Interim Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
Senate Committee is adjourned.